Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host for the next 30 minutes. This is another in our ongoing series, The Week in Reviews, a chance to sit down one-on-one with someone from the literary world. My guest today is author Geoffrey Wood. Geoffrey has just released a delightfully amusing new book, Lift Fatales, Inner Peace. Geoffrey, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Simon.
Maybe we could start with a little background information. Who is Geoffrey Wood?
Well, Geoffrey Wood is a brand new published author living in Scarborough, New York on the Hudson River, who works full-time, believe it or not, for an organization in downtown New York called American Institute of Chemical Engineers. And I am not a chemical engineer. I'm a liberal arts major, which puts me in a distinct minority at that organization.
I'll bet.
Yes, but I've been living here in New York for about 22 years and finally made a dream come true and published my first novel.
So, Lift Fatales, Inner Peace is your first foray into the literary world.
Indeed it is.
I do understand, though, that it's not the first book you've written. Do you not have a children's book sitting in the wings somewhere?
I do. It's called The Backwards Man. It's a delightful book about a little man who was born when he was 92 years old and becomes younger and younger. Unfortunately, Benjamin Button, the movie, came out first. I wrote the book first, although F. Scott Fitzgerald actually wrote the book first, but the movie came out, which kind of meant that one stays on the shelf a little bit. But Lift Fatales is part of a trilogy, and the other two books are written.
Without giving away the plot, Can you tell us a little bit about the story for the Inner Peace volume?
Well, Inner Peace is a bit of a pun. Don't want to spoil it like you asked me, but the Earth's core has speeded up in the book, and it's about to tear the Earth apart. And Lift settles down onto my back porch one day because we have an alliance that we've agreed to in the first volume. And says we need to do something about this. And I ask what, and he says, well, we're going to build a liquid nitrogen tunnel around the outer core of the Earth, which hopefully will cool off the inner core. And then we're off to any number of varied and sundry adventures throughout the book.
Oh, it is actually a fabulous story, and I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed it. I know that your plan is for a trilogy of books, and you mentioned that you do have the other two books written. Why did you release book two first?
Well, it's an interesting question, and you're not the first one to have asked that, including the bookstore owner over at the Village Bookstore in Pleasantville, New York. It is a bit provocative to do volume two first, but I did it because of the timeliness of the subject matter within the book, which is related to terrorist activity around the globe. And so there is that part of the book that relates to that, and I thought that the book was so timely it needed to be released first, and that's really the reason why I did it.
Okay. I love the story, and I particularly enjoyed the constant string of trivia that you include in it. I love trivia, and you know, I read so much. I'm this huge sort of fountain of trivia, and when I read your book, I knew I had met my match. I mean, I take it you are pretty well traveled. For example, there are not too many people on this side of the pond that know what a PIMS number one is. I mean, Have you traveled extensively?
Somewhat, although not of late. But I've been to Europe several times and enjoy Europe greatly. I've always wanted to get to Asia. I haven't had a chance to, although my wife did. And but this book, as you know from reading it, was highly researched. Every single aspect of the book, except, of course, for the plot, is accurate. And I did a lot of research on the Internet and a lot of research from my own travels, as you indicated. But I think the trivia is probably from my background as a history major in college.
Oh, that would make a good deal of sense. For the listeners, let me give you some examples. There's a section that talks about Kilroy. Who was Kilroy?
Kilroy was a ship inspector during World War II, and he inspected ships. And when the message was left Kilroy was there, then the Axis powers thought that it was a spy amongst them, and they searched all over Europe for Kilroy. But actually, Kilroy was nothing more than a ship inspector with the units in World War II latching onto it and making great fun with it.
Right. And it became a very stylized cartoon character. The,
right.
The nose poking over the wall, as I recall, or something like that.
Right.
Yes. You also talk about smoked carp, which is not something you see on too many restaurant menus anymore, but definitely a historical fact.
Well, you know, when the trout are fished out, the fishermen turn to something. In this case, it had to be carp.
Right. Where did the idea for the plot come from?
Well, that's an interesting question. The scene actually takes place in my at my first home in Briarcliff Manor, and there was a retaining wall that ran about 180 feet in front of the property. It was 23 feet high, and at various times, various types of animals lived in that wall. There was a hole in the wall, and I got to thinking about it, and I said, "What if a little character lived in that wall?" My wife said, "Well, you ought to write a book about it." Well, I came home one night, and the TV was on, which is stultifyingly dull, as we all know. And I decided there needs to be more to life than just sitting down and watching Entertainment Tonight. So I decided I would write a book, and I announced it to my wife, and she saw me about 3.5 years later.
Did you actually write all three books sort of back-to-back?
I did. I actually started with Volume 1. And then did the second one and finished the third one in February. And it's kind of amazing when I tell people this, but each time before I sat down to write the book of any one of the three volumes, I had the whole book in my head, which is, I just don't know how I did it, but I did.
Wow. Yes, that is quite remarkable. I mean, there are many writers who sit down, you know, and have no clue where the plot is going to lead. In fact, I'm not a book author, but I do a lot of writing, and I can honestly say that even a 1,000 or 2,000 word story, more often than not, the story evolves as the words appear on the paper. Rarely do I have it completely mapped out. I think you are quite unusual in that aspect.
Well, I don't know if I am or not, but I do know that's the way it went, and I cannot write from an outline. I have to just go with the flow, and that's what I did. Each book took me a little bit over a year to write. And I wrote anywhere from 4 a.m. to 7 a.m. every single morning for about 3.5 years.
Wow. What a way to start your day.
Yes, without coffee even.
Oh, dear. That's illegal, isn't it? Many people think that writing a book is the hard part, but it isn't. You know, I'm sorry, folks. I have to tell you, writing the book is not the hard part. There's two other hard parts. Publishing is often a tough nut to crack. What was your experience with the publishing houses? You know, traditional, self-publishing. What routes did you try?
Well, I wasted about a year and a half trying to solicit agents. And the publishing industry is so paranoid now, as we all know, and maybe rightly so, especially in this economy, that no one wants to touch anybody unless they have an established reputation. It's a little bit of a tough nut. And so I looked into self-publishing, and I decided that I would go that route. And I did it with an outfit called iUniverse, mm-hmm. whom I'm relatively happy with, I have to say. I would agree with you, Simon, that writing the book is not the hardest part. I think the most difficult part, other than getting published, and anyone can get published if they really want to get published, so you can do the self-publishing route if you want to. But I think the two other parts that are the hardest for me, and one of them's ongoing, the editorial is very tough. We went through 5 edits, and it was a very, very tough process.
Yes.
Time-consuming. Very time-consuming.
Well, not only time-consuming, but can be a highly frustrating process. Because as the author have put your heart and soul into it, and here is this, you know, person that is a relative unknown doing hacking and slashing. You know, no one likes that.
In all candor, we added 30 pages to the book, which is unheard of.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, nothing was slashed. Here and there, a couple of paragraphs, a couple of words, but we added 30 pages to the book, which I thought highly unusual, but having done this my first time, I just took it for what it was.
It's been my experience, and I base this on hundreds of conversations with authors, that editors tend to come in two flavors. There's the traditional hack-and-slash editor, and then there's this other flavor that I've heard a really unique term used to describe them. They're a story shepherd, and their mission in life is to work with the author and try and help find where they're, you know, that there are gaps in the flow, and it sounds like your editor is of the story shepherd variety, you know, actually helping you ensure that the flow is there, and that's one of the reasons that you added 30 pages.
Absolutely, that's exactly what happened, and you know, if you really look at the book closely, it's written in the first person. A lot of books are written in the third person. I chose to do it in the first person, and there's a lot of autobiographical things in the book that relate to me, but sometimes I would lapse out of that and go into the wrong person as I would get excited when I was writing and forget who I was writing for. And so you're right, they shepherded me back onto the first person from when I gave an improper perspective in the book relative to what some of Lyft's actions were. So that's exactly what they did with my experience.
We have writing the book's a bit of a challenge, publishing it's a much bigger challenge, editing it is a challenge, and of course the final challenge, which is as daunting as all of the others, marketing the book. Somehow you have to persuade people that they need to own it. What are you doing in by way of marketing? Are you doing book signings, things like that?
Well, the dreaded M word, Simon. yes, indeed. It's if you haven't blown your budget by publishing the book, you sure will when you market it. one of the issues in marketing is to have some sort of a budget. Fair warning for those of you who really think that you want to get into this. I have done email campaigns. There's an email campaign that's going out under the auspice of iUniverse to 1 million people in November. It's a pretty big email campaign. We have marketed on the internet through a website called Goodreads, and we gave away two versions of the book, and that generated some buzz in the literary community. And we're doing our traditional marketing by trying to locate it in individual bookstores around Westchester here in New York and at libraries. Anything that generates a buzz is a good thing in the book world.
Right.
And
I mean, every author's dream is to get that book on a bookstore's shelf. And
exactly. That
is a very difficult proposition.
It is indeed.
The R.R. Boker Company, who are the keepers of all knowledge and wisdom on the subject of ISBN numbers, released the 2008 statistics, and there was something in the order of 300,000 new titles published in the U.S. alone. Now, how many books does the average, independent bookstore have? Maybe 5,000, maybe 10,000 if it's a larger store. I mean, it's tough to get that book on the shelf. You know, the most authors that have managed to do that have done it through, sheer grit and determination. Knocking on doors. Is that the approach that you're taking?
It is, to a degree. I went to one bookstore, which will remain unnamed. the manager of the bookstore has a policy that he will not speak to authors. He will only speak to publishing houses. So with my head hung down between my knees, I walked out of the bookstore, and I wrote him an email. And asked him why, and he didn't reply. So you have to have a thick skin to do this.
Oh, yes.
A thick skin.
I have a friend who owns a publishing house, actually in New York. It's a fairly niche house dealing with history, modern history in particular. And I like to help him out and tried to do some promotion for him here in Mississippi, and we live in a small town. There's one bookstore, so I put copies of his books and a catalog in a bag and trudged off to introduce myself to the owner of the bookstore, who looked at me as if I had three heads and came from Mars. If I wasn't repping New York Times bestseller list or Harlequin novels, she didn't want to talk to me. Yep.
That's my experience.
Yeah, very, very tough business to do. What sort of reader feedback are you getting on Les Fatales?
Everyone whom I have been in contact with who has read the book loves it. They love it. They think it's a wonderful book. My brother-in-law is slogging through it, although he doesn't like so much the beginning of the book because it has a lot of history and the historical background in it, but he's not a history buff. So that's the one well, shall I say, lukewarm review I've received, but he hasn't finished the book yet, so I told him to wait till till the jury comes back in.
Right. I mean, you did say brother-in-law, didn't you?
Yeah, he is my brother-in-law, so, I'll give him a little bit of flack.
That's right. He's not a blood relative. another marketing tool that most authors use is the internet. Do you have a website supporting Lifvertells?
I do. It's www.lift. I call it Fatals.
Fatals, I'm sorry.
That's all right. Most people give it on the other syllable. Liftfatals.com.
Okay, and where can people buy the book? Uh-oh, he's gone quiet. Oh, dear. I think we might just have lost Jeffrey, but hopefully he will dial back in. While I'm waiting for Jeffrey to dial back in, here's a short piece of music, which is one of my favorites. Jeffrey,
it seems
you're back.
Our local phone company took exception to the book.
Oh, dear. By the way, are you much of a music lover?
Love music.
Did you recognize that short snatch of piano?
I did not, because I clicked one too fast.
Oh, okay. Oh, it was... One of my favorite 17th century British hymns, All Things Bright and Beautiful.
How wonderful is that?
Oh, it's a fabulous, fabulous piece of music. Okay, where were we? I wanted to ask you, where can people purchase copies of Lifvertells?
They can purchase it on the three majors online, which is Barnes & Noble, Amazon, and Borders. It is being marketed to independent bookstores around the country from iUniverse, my publisher, because I'm in the Rising Star program, which means they feel the book has commercial viability, but I don't know where that stands right now.
Okay, and in fact, that was going to be my very next question. I know that it's early days, but are you getting any feedback on how the book is selling?
Well, iUniverse lists how it's doing. The other day, it went down to 65,000 on their bestseller list.
Oh.
Me being a newly published author, I'm not sure what that means, but I believe they have something like 27 million volumes on their website. So.
Right.
To me, that's not bad.
Oh no, indeed, that's not bad at all. I often look at Amazon to see statistics for books that I'm either reviewing or have reviewed, and it's not unusual to see books in the 1 or even 2 million position. So 65,000, that's not bad going at all. And again, I go back to the Boka data of 300,000 new titles a year. 65,000, not bad going at all, Jeffrey.
I'll take it.
Right. In some ways, your writing style reminds me a little of the late Douglas Adams. Who are your writing influences, and who are your favorite authors?
Well, they're strangely enough, they're not fantasy or science fiction, although I have read a lot of that genre. I really like James Lee Burke, who writes detective novels, the Dave Robichaud novels set in New Orleans. And I particularly have an affinity for Gerald Seymour, who's a marvelous English author who does different types of books that are contemporary with the times in which we live. I just read his book, The Walking Dead, which was a wonderful, wonderful novel. And so those are probably my two favorite contemporary authors.
Hmm.
Aside from Charles Dickens, of course.
Ah, of course. You mentioned earlier that you do have volumes 1 and 3 complete.
They are complete. Yes.
Which one are you going to go with next? You know, 1 or 3? And do you have any idea on time frame?
Well, Simon, that's a very good question, and it's a logical question, but the only answer I can give is we'll see how Volume 2 does, because the budget is running low.
Right.
So we need to build the coffers back up in order to do this again.
Well, I sincerely hope that happens. I have a friend who is an author. In fact, I met him through his first book and then his second book, and you know, we subsequently have become friends. And he just received a letter from his publisher saying that the sales figures were in, and he had sold 50,000 copies in the U.S. and 20,000 copies in Europe. He is ecstatic. So I do hope that you get similar results.
Well, it would be very nice to have that happen, because it would be a travesty to not publish all three, because the other two are as good, if not better, than this one.
Right.
That is totally subjective, of course.
Totally subjective. you mentioned earlier that you wrote all three books back to back, getting up at 4 a.m. every morning and writing till 7 a.m. Makes you sound like a pretty disciplined writer. You know, there's people like that, and the other style, of course, is the writer who only writes when the mood takes him. Are you still writing?
Not at the moment, but Lyft is starting to flit around in my head again, bothering me with another plot. So I think probably there might be a fourth volume, but am I writing right at the moment? No. I'm more concerned with the marketing of this particular volume.
Right.
But I probably will do something else. I probably need some sort of a famous or infamous scenario in order to tag Lyft onto, to make sure that it's a problem of epic and global proportions.
Look, let's talk about this infamous character, Lyft Fatals. Tell us the spelling, and tell us a little bit about what the name means.
Well, it's a little bit more of a pun. The spelling is L-Y-F-T, that's one word, and then the second word is fatals, F-A-E-T-E-L-S. It comes from Old English, and the two words put together, although I'm sure that Chaucer would forgive me, mean bag of air. And it's a pun, because Lyft is invisible and he can float and fly, and he also sits on my shoulder and fills my ear with historical proselytization and never gives up.
Yes, he is a delightful character. I mean, just endless pearls of wisdom come spilling out of him. He also does enjoy food and booze.
Yes, indeed.
In fact, all of your characters seem to enjoy food and booze.
Kind of takes after the author, you know.
That segues nicely into the question about, you know, many authors I talk to when I ask them about the characters they use in the book, you know, base them on real people or at least caricatures of real people. I presume that is what you have done.
A little bit. I would have to say that lifts my partial alter ego, because that's what people have read into it who know me. So,
I'm sure that we have some aspiring writers that are listening in. What advice do you have for anyone that thinks they want to become an author?
Well, it's like Churchill said in World War II, never, never, never give up. It's easy to give up, because you can run a paragraph by somebody and they can say, oh, that's just horrible. What do you want to write for? Or you could have someone read the book and they pan it in the manuscript, you know, stage. And then you get discouraged and you don't want to go onward and you don't think it's going to be worth the money, and, you know, it goes on forever. I would say for anybody who wants to write, just sit down and do it. And anybody who is of any reasonable intelligence can write. I mean, I came to this quite late in life. I wrote these novels. I started them in my late 50s. So it's not like I've been writing all my life. But I had an idea, and I wanted to get it across on all three books. And I was just absolutely determined to do it. And I'm the type of person that when I say it out loud to someone and I say I'm going to do something, I do it. And I did it. And I'm proud of that accomplishment. But I could have been very easily discouraged at several points along the journey, and I wasn't. And I just kept at it.
Oh, I think all of these endeavors, you've got to put your heart and soul into it. In fact, the amusing story I tell about myself. I woke up one morning, sat bolt upright in bed, and prodded my wife and said, "You know what, dear? I'm going to become a book reviewer." And she groggily sort of looked at me and said, "That's nice, dear." Rolled over and promptly went back to sleep. And now, that's exactly what I do. Actually, books, movies, music, TV, you name it, I review it.
And you do it very well.
Thank you. I do it because I enjoy it. And
your experience was the same as mine. When I told my wife I was going to write a book, she says, "Well, that's nice."
Exactly. In fact, my poor wife, I actually have dragged into the fun. Every day she would sit in front of the TV and watch some soap operas. So I kept nagging her, and now the poor woman does it as a job. She has to review the soap operas.
Well said.
Yeah. And I'll say something to her like, you know, "So, how are the soaps today?" And she goes, "It's a damn job."
Well, writing something like that,
yeah,
writing's a damn job. if you don't treat it as a labor of love, and if it's not a labor of love, it'll show in the writing. I hate to say it.
Yes, that is entirely true. And I see that all too much in well-established authors. They have lost the hunger, they've just become an industry. Now, I think that shows through in authors like Tom Clancy. I mean, he was wonderfully new, fresh, with his early novels, The Hunt for Red October. But gradually over time, he's just become a book industry, you know, which is a shame.
Yeah, a lot of authors have done that. I thought his Red Storm Rising was just a phenomenal book, just one of the best. And then he started to collaborate with another author, and then they were diluted, it seemed.
Yes, yeah, very much so. Almost as if they'd written a piece of computer software, you know, where you plug in a few basic details and it will spew out a 600-page boring novel.
That's exactly right.
Jeffrey,
when I wrote this novel, I had that passion, and I hope it shows.
Oh, it most definitely does. I think it's one of the freshest books I have read in quite some time, and I specialize in first-time authors. But yeah, you definitely have what it takes. And I sincerely hope that the book does well for you. And I do hope it does so well that you're going to be having volumes 1 and 3 released before we know it.
Thank you, Simon. Greatly appreciate it.
Alas, our time is just about up here. So I really want to thank Jeffrey Wood for joining us this afternoon. And everyone here at Blogger News, we wish you every success.
Thank you.
It has been my pleasure talking to you, and I do hope we talk again in the future. This is Simon Barrett for Blogger News Network, wishing everyone a wonderful day. Goodbye.